Vietnam, according to accepted wisdom, launched a surprise attack in Hanoi on French installations. And then when the French counterattacked, and during this cover attack, the Viet Minh withdrew their regular forces out into the countryside to prepare positions up in the Viet Bac, obviously preparing for the beginning of a long, protracted war. That's the kind of accepted wisdom on what's happened. And the French, of course, said that it was a treacherous attack a la Pearl Harbor. The Viet Minh countered that they were driven to war by the French. A couple of interesting speculations that have been coming along recently, and I've seen no confirmation of it, and I'm still at the point of withholding judgment. A young Norwegian scholar wrote a book called, I'll think about it in a minute, I don't remember the title of all of a sudden, but it's a book in French, and anyway, it, for those of you who read French, Déclenchement de la guerre d'Indochine. But his point is that he thinks, based on circumstantial evidence that Ho Chi Minh was not quite ready to commit to war. He was still waiting to hear from Leon Blum, who had come into office recently. Is it Leon, by the way, if I got the right one? Because it was Robert, it was Leon, I guess. And Ho Chi Minh, as some of you know, sent a last-minute peace appeal to Paris, which was delayed in Saigon and not sent on to Paris until too late. And it opens up a lot of questions. Why did the Viet Minh start the war just when they were making a last-minute appeal? We don't have an answer to it, but this young Norwegian scholar's speculation, based on seeing recent documents in the archives in Paris, is that perhaps militant elements, either within the ICP or in non-communist parties still attached, or let's say still active in Hanoi, created provocations which led to the attack. I won't go into detail of that. There are also some ideas from some people that the French provoked the Viet Minh in various ways, in a manner like the Tu Pai because it's in that period, as I said before, when the French ratify the Élysée Accords, and it's at that point when the Truman administration, in its own recognizance, takes the plunge. It says, all right, we're going to back you. And I remember we were talking about this last fall. Acheson had a number of, he really vacillated on it during the fall of 1949. And I think you remember I brought up the fact that Acheson had been all over the lot on our China policy also. He was inclined for a while to sort of let the dust settle in China and consider the possibility of dealing with the communists in China and detaching them from Soviet influence. And it was only late in the year and early in 1950 when Acheson and the administration began to come down on a tougher, more anti-communist line. Certainly, one of the factors was the increasing fear of the French as the Chinese communists crossed the Yangtze and began nearing South China. The French became briefly really quite panicking about the possibility of a direct Chinese involvement in the war. In fact, not only the French, but there was nervousness Great Britain, and of course in the United States as well about this. And this was sort of in back of this whole context of what was happening, the question of American diplomatic recognition of the associated state and that sort of thing. The French began to ask the United States to make some kind of commitment to provide direct military assistance and involvement in Indochina should the new People's Republic of China directly cross the border and help the Viet Minh. At a minimum, of course, the communist victory in China would provide the Viet Minh with vast increases in military equipment. It would provide them with a sanctuary. It would provide them with the possibility of air support in any operations they might undertake and that sort of thing. And this is something that had come up during the conversation earlier about the attitude of the U.S. military and that sort of thing. The basic reaction of the United States to this kind of situation was based on the very limited number of American, the limited American military capability at that time, was to indicate a refusal on the part of the United States to become actively involved militarily with helping the French in Indochina if the Chinese attacked. And the approach taken by the Joint Chiefs of Staff was that if the Chinese intervened directly or indicated that they might become involved indirectly, the attitude of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was that the United States should strike directly at the source of the aggression in China rather than become involved in the Indochina conflict itself. And in staff talks that took place between the Americans, the British, and the French from 49 down to 50 in 1951, this is the basic position that the United States adopted. And this position made the French and the British very nervous because, in effect, to them, it implied that any kind of local regional crisis in Southeast Asia could rapidly escalate into a regional conflict which might eventually become global war. And this disagreement over the way in which the United States might eventually become involved in helping the French really did not get ironed out right up until the Geneva Conference. And I think you can understand the difference in the American military perspective, of course, one that would eventually be shared by Eisenhower, that the United States should not become involved if possible in the land war in Asia. Of course, this is all affected by Korea. Why don't we take a few minutes break here, and then we can go back and talk about Korea and China. say a few words about the decision and the conditions surrounding the decision by the Truman administration to recognize the Associated State of Vietnam and to begin providing military and economic assistance. And I guess specifically why, or why at that particular time. In other words, the hypothesis I'm presenting to you here is that whatever may have gone on inadvertently or under the table, there was no intent on the part of the Truman administration to provide any direct assistance to the French in Indochina until early 1950. Once that decision was made, we were committed, no doubt of that. To me, there are a couple of factors, and perhaps the main one and the most obvious one is the changing attitudes in Washington to the global threat from communism. I think the intensity of Cold War concerns increased rapidly in the months following the final collapse of Chiang Kai-shek in China, the exploding of the first Soviet atomic device, and there may have been a variety of other things going on that slipped my mind for a moment, but I mentioned to you late last week that the debate over the communist threat increased significantly during the early months of 1950, and there seems no doubt that it had an effect on the thinking of the Truman administration, in all likelihood, including Secretary of State Dean Acheson. And I mentioned the fact that it led to the replacement of a number of top State Department officials with new individuals who took a stronger line on communism than had been the case with their predecessors. So I think that's definitely one factor. The hesitation in late 1949 to reach any decision on what to do in the aftermath of the fall of China was replaced in early 1950 with a determination that something had to be done. It culminated, as we mentioned before, with the National Security Council memorandum in April 1950. And that paper made a fairly blanket statement that the United States would have to contain communism wherever it raised its head in order to protect American interests. Previously, American security policy in Asia had been more selective, and it had in effect stated that the United States would defend an offshore island chain from Japan down through the Ryukyu Islands to the Philippines, and as they said, possibly Indonesia. It did not include Taiwan. After NSC 68, the policy was now broadened, although there was no firm commitment to go into war on the mainland. In fact, no such commitment was made even in 1954. The United States was clearly going to become more actively involved indirectly to try to help the French and the British to stabilize the area against the advance of communism. The second factor that I think entered into the decision to accept the diplomatic recognition and to support the French was an increased conviction that without the French, the Vietnamese could not do it alone. I mentioned this before. There may have been some wishful thinking in the Truman administration up to 1949 that maybe if the French granted independence to the Vietnamese would very quickly get their act together and we wouldn't need the French. The Vietnamese could do it themselves. Well, Thao Dai's performance or lack of performance as chief of state during the months before and after the signature of the Élysée Accords created quite a disappointment among American officials. And I think they became aware of the fact that whatever the amount of independence that Thao Dai had, the Vietnamese could not carry the load to defend against the Vietnam, which meant, of course, that if we wanted to stop communism in Indochina, we had to keep the French there, which obviously undercuts any argument we have to force concessions out of them. A third factor, I think, is the growing strength of the Vietnam themselves. By early 1950, and certainly by late 50, but I'm obviously focusing on early 1950, it's quite clear that the Vietnam are preparing to go on the offensive, and there are countless reports in American intelligence community about increasing contacts between Chinese communist forces on the Chinese side of the border and the Vietnam, and a lot of speculation about what it's going to mean. But clearly the danger appears greater. One other underlying factor, and this goes back to the point you brought up late last week, why did we support a government which we knew was weak? And you brought it up not necessarily in this immediate period, but in a more general sense, and I can answer it in a more general sense, not only now, but later on in 51, 52, 53, when the weakness of the Bao Dai government is ever more apparent, and even after 1954, when Ngo Dinh Diem's weaknesses are apparent. And the answer I gave to you was that the feeling of the Truman administration and later of key figures in the Eisenhower administration was that even if the leadership in Vietnam was so weak that we could not save it. In other words, even if we could not save Vietnam, and there was a clear recognition that that was a possibility, it was important to make the effort. In that sense, at that time, it was not so much done in terms of American credibility. That's an argument you're more likely to hear under Lyndon Johnson or under John Kennedy. But at this particular time period, the feeling was that the danger was not simply Indochina. The danger was a collapse of what was called the free world position all throughout that area, as they would say at the time, extending from the Suez Canal to the Japanese islands. And the perspective, I try to be as fair as I can when I make my own judgment. When you look back at that period, there is no doubt that there were a series of highly unstable, newly independent governments all over that area, and the reports coming back from Bangkok, Jakarta, and Singapore, I'm trying to think what was Pakistan at that time, I guess you had East and West Pakistan, but you know what I mean. Burma was of a very, very perilous situation, which led many policymakers to feel that if Indochina collapsed, or if Vietnam won in Indochina, there would be a very rapid adjustment of many of these newly independent governments in the communist favor. So the idea was, if we can win in Vietnam, let's do it. But even if we don't win in Vietnam, let's stay there long enough to buy time for these other governments to stabilize themselves. One final point I'll make here is that not only did the United States make that judgment, but leading foreign policy figures in the British government and the French government made it as well. They didn't always draw the same conclusions as we did, but they had that same fear. So my answer to you on that is, in other words, that the question wasn't just can we save Vietnam. The question is, we should try to save it, because if we can't, we've desperately got to buy enough time to stabilize the rest of the area. And that was the way a lot of the thinking was going. I saw a couple of hands here.
Quick question. When you say Vietnam, you mean Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, or just Vietnam?
It was describing Vietnam
because it's a state.
But let me just adjust it here. In 49 and 50, there wasn't any perceived sense of threat to Laos and Cambodia, but the assumption was that Laos and Cambodia would go events that took place in the next couple of years. They were important in various ways, but not crucial, because I'll want to focus mainly on 53-54 for the remainder of the time. 1950, in this sense, brings the United States into the Indochina conflict. It now clearly sees the Franco-Vietnam War as part of the Cold War, and we see China in back of the Viet Minh, and there's a lot of speculation over the next 2 years whether or not the Chinese are likely to be involved. I might say, to the credit of U.S. intelligence services, that almost unanimously CIA reports, military intelligence reports, discounted the likelihood of active Chinese military involvement. The French seem to be much more concerned about it, maybe because they were trying to squeeze more aid out of Uncle Sam. But the point is, there was that concern. It also, as we saw last week, it brought the Viet Minh more into the Cold War, in the sense that it obviously increased the potential for significant military assistance from China. In the spring of 1950, actually from January through March and April 1950, a series of agreements for economic and military assistance were signed between the DRV and the PRC, and in consequence, on the one hand, the Viet Minh began to follow the model, the Chinese model, more specifically in ideological terms, and with Chinese advice and training began to prepare for what they assumed would be their stage of general offensive. They launched the first stage in the fall of 1950, the so-called border offensive, which I always mention because it is reminiscent to me of I'm not so sure what I also let the conclusion work itself out. The border offensive in the fall of 1950, the Viet Minh opened up the entire border. The French, relatively speaking, abandoned the entire border, which opened up North Vietnam to Chinese assistance. The French did not see the very basic way in which this undermined any possibility of a military victory, although American military strategists did. As I said, I'm a little bit reminded of comparing that to the decision we made in 1973 when the United States signed the Paris Agreement, which brought peace to Vietnam but allowed 160,000 North Vietnamese troops to stay in the South. What in hell did the White House think they were going to do? It was a way, you know, sort of putting blinders over yourself and thinking that you had peace. But in any case, the fall offensive then led the following January to a series of sharp jabs on the edges of the Red River Delta. Jopp's heralded general offensive that the Viet Minh and their hubris had argued would lead them to occupy Hanoi before the end of the year. I expect most of you have heard of the famous General De La Tour de Tassigny, who arrived in the nick of time with his guns blazing and was able to put down these offensives, I might say, to some degree with the help of American military assistance. And in fact, 1951, the 1 year that De La Tour was High Commissioner and Commander-in-Chief in Vietnam, was probably the best year Vietnam ever had in terms of rising morale and the general improvement in the military situation. The Viet Minh reacted to this by retreating to the second stage and adopting a kind of Indochina-wide theater of operations. They now, instead of attacking the French directly, tried to divide up French forces by attacking key areas in Laos, shaping up of this idea of this sort of special relationship because of the long, vulnerable boundary that they had and the importance of Laos and Cambodia to their national security. So 1952 was a bad year. The degree of American military assistance under the last year of the Truman administration increased steadily. We lost, based on my reading of the situation, we lost any leverage with the French. In fact, the Truman administration came to an end totally without ideas on Vietnam. I mean, they bequeathed the Indochina situation to the Eisenhower administration. It was totally bereft of any ideas. It was simply, let's hope the French make out. It was that simple. And our commitment, however, was still limited. Eisenhower came into office watching among you. I know some of you are old enough to remember the Eisenhower slogans and that sort of thing. Eisenhower came in with at least a verbal commitment to roll back the tide of communism, or at least prevent the further expansion of communism. The Eisenhower people focused their minds on Indochina. It was one of the relatively few areas that was a sort of crisis point. It was unlike the Kennedy year, when Kennedy had about four or five crisis points at once. And I think the Eisenhower administration came into office with a clear determination to reinvigorate the struggle in Indochina to achieve a victory. The basic feeling of the Eisenhower people was that the French simply had lost their commitment, they lost their vigor, and the Eisenhower people felt that the basic requirement was to push the French to put new vigor in the war. I think they deal with it primarily as a military problem rather than a political one. Unfortunately for the Eisenhower administration, they came into office approximately at a time when I think the French began to realize that there was no victory in sight at all. And I think by now, in fact, it may even have been by late 1952, the French were beginning to grope in a general way, there were some changes of government involved here, for some kind of negotiated settlement of the war. So you have Paris and Washington operating at cross purposes. When the Eisenhower sent a team over to Paris to talk to the prime minister at the time, said, we'll help you if you provide a reinvigoration of the war effort. The French came up with a plan that had very little to offer. Eisenhower pressed harder and harder, and finally in the spring, the French appointed a new high commissioner, or a new commander-in-chief. You all, of course, have heard of Henri Navarre, who came up with that famous Navarre plan, which seemed to promise substantial success in about 2 years. And on the basis of that plan, which, by the way, most American military strategists had some skepticism about the plan from the start, but during the late spring and summer of 1953, the French were able to flesh out the Navarre plan sufficiently so that in August, the Eisenhower administration came up with a big price tag grant of aid, conditional on the French carrying out this massive plan to regain the initiative in the war. The French prime minister at that time, by the way, those of you who are French historians will know, was Joseph Laniel. I don't know an awful lot about him, but the American administration officials felt that he was the last best hope for victory in Indochina. In other words, Laniel appeared willing to give one more try to achieving victory. And I think if we look under the surface, we might find that Laniel and his cabinet might even so have said, we won't get total victory. Let's use American aid point is, the Eisenhower people were aware that if Lanier fell, because of declining support for the war in France, that a negotiated settlement under highly disadvantageous conditions was very likely. So that's the overall context of the Navarre plan. The Eisenhower people were hoping very much that the Navarre plan would provide the stepping stone to an effective military victory. Anybody want to raise anything on that?